Welcome to Think About It, a podcast from Houston Baptist University here in Houston, Texas. At HBU, we empower our students so their beliefs can fuel their lives. We prepare our students to thrive at the university level and beyond. And now we join our host, Dr. Jerry Johnson, with today's guest.
I'm Dr. Chris Hammonds. I'm a professor of political science here at Houston Baptist University and the director of the Morris Family Center for Law and Liberty. And the mission of the center is to teach American history and promote our nation's founding principles. And it was started really sort of as an academic initiative back in 2007 when we noticed an increasing number of students who came to us with very little knowledge of American history or our nation's founding principles. So we started offering some extracurricular activities that involved faculty lectures and guest speakers that covered a variety of topics, things like the origins of our Constitution or the importance of the Declaration of Independence or various personalities during the American founding period. And from that, by about 2013, we began to think about what would a home for what we were calling the Center for Law and Liberty look like. And that took on a lot of different sort of incarnations, but clearly we wanted something that would send an outward and visible sign for what our mission and values were. And the natural sort of building that we kept returning to was something that looked like Independence Hall in Philadelphia. So Dr. Stuart Morris, who's our university benefactor and founding father, began sort of chairing a committee for us to reach out to individuals who might be interested in supporting that academic initiative. And I think as he got more and more involved in the process and became a stronger and stronger advocate for it, he and his family decided to make a gift to make that building a reality here on campus. So if you visit the campus, you'll see the construction on the northeast side, which is really a five-building complex with the center main building modeled after Independence Hall in Philadelphia. And it's in the process of being sort of bricked out now, so it's starting to look more and more like the original in Philly. The iconic tower that is so emblematic of Independence Hall will come sometime in the early spring semester, maybe January or February. And that will be the same height as the current construction, so that'll be the biggest thing on the campus, even the whole city block and visible from the highway. Maybe we can light that up on football games when we win, orange or blue or something. And there'll be two attached buildings that are smaller classroom-sized buildings. One will be a room dedicated to the study of free enterprise and free market with a lot of collaboration-type software and integration built into the building. The other building will be some sort of welcome center, visitor-type center. So when people come to campus to tour the building and visit, we'll have a place to greet them and start those sort of conversations and tours. And then behind the Independence Hall building will be two classroom buildings. One of them is being framed now. They're three stories. They will hold a mix of faculty office space, a mix of classroom space, places for students to congregate. And it's in those buildings that the teaching that we do on a daily basis will take place. We'll offer classes in history, in political science, and law, philosophy, economics in those buildings. And then the main attraction in the Independence Hall building will be on the first floor, that famous signing room where the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were created. And that room will be as historically accurate as we can possibly make it, so much so that when you look at the architectural renderings, it looks like a photograph of the one in Philadelphia. We've even contacted the gentleman who is in charge of all the furnishings of the room in Philadelphia, and he digitized everything for historical preservation purposes years ago, and he hand creates the furniture for the one in Philly. So we've contracted it with him to recreate all the furniture, so it just looks just like the room in Philadelphia, all the way down to the famous rising sun chair at the front of the hall. And our hope is that this will be a place that we can not only bring our own HBU students down for special classes and special lectures, to give them a sense of time and place as to what the American founding was all about and the tough questions that the founders faced, but that we can also invite area school groups from all over the city to come and visit our campus and talk about our nation's founding principles. And what we want those students to understand is that really no matter what you look like or where you're from or who your parents are, that the principles that are enshrined in our nation's founding documents are important to your future, and they're important to study, and they're important to preserve. And that's really at the heart of what the Morris Family Center for Law and Liberty is all about. It's not an organization or an entity or an endeavor that looks toward the past just for the sake of studying history. It is an endeavor that focuses on the past for the purposes of working toward a better future tomorrow by focusing on our nation's founding principles.
Dr. Hammons, it is really a delight to have you, and I just love your leadership. I love the vision that you're casting, and Dr. Tyler, your whole cadre is just unbelievable. I mean, I'm one of your biggest cheerleaders. I want to point out two of your books, Origins of Our Founding Principles, the preceding book, Constitutionalism of the United of the American States. Why those two books, and tell me about them.
Yeah, so the last one, Origins of Our Founding Principles, was a collaborative effort by me and Dr. Tyler, Dr. Joseph, really all of my colleagues in the political science and history departments. And it was an effort to try to sort of encapsulate everything we're teaching, not only in our classes, but through our outreach through the Morris Family Center for Law and Liberty. So I asked everybody to sort of let's narrow down everything we talk about and try to get it down to five or six key principles and then write a book around those principles. And the book sort of focuses on the origins of where those ideas that went into our nation's founding documents came from. So it starts with the ancient Greeks, moves through the ancient Romans, moves through the English Civil Wars into the American Revolutionary period. That's where sort of the historical chronological track of tracing those ideas. But there's also sort of a legal history in there, philosophical orientation, and some theological aspects as well. The idea that the belief that our rights come from God is sort of unique to the American experience. So for anyone interested in sort of a sweeping overview of where our founders got the ideas that went into our nation's founding documents, that's a good place to start.
Excellent. And then okay, we've covered that. Now, I want to go back to the building. I mean, sure. This is just, we're showing B-roll right now of the construction. And of course, it's not the finished building, which will be breathtaking. And my goodness, the description you gave in the intro about the replica of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, amazing. I mean, how did all this develop? I mean, this must have been an idea in your head one afternoon, huh?
Right. Well, it sounds a little crazy to some extent that you would want to build a replica of Independence Hall on campus
in Houston.
And some people said that. This is kind of a crazy idea.
But I love crazy ideas.
So about 15 years ago, I was teaching a class on the American founding and the Constitutional Convention. And I got some seed money from a small grant to host sort of a mock Constitutional Convention with our students. And we took a classroom, we put green tablecloths out, some parchment paper, some little quill pens, the students dressed up in business attire. And the goal was to sort of give them a sense of time and place as to what it was like at the Constitutional Convention. And I found a couple of things. One was that the students sort of got into it, right, because they could get a better feel of what was at stake. A lot of the men who were at that convention had fought during the Revolutionary War, and they had just thrown off a strong, centralized, powerful government in England. They were very protective of their liberties, and they were not certain as to what they were getting into with this proposed new constitution. And when the argument is framed that way, and we would read the Anti-Federalist papers and opponents of the Constitution, the students would necessarily try to sort of recreate those arguments for or against the Constitution as they were sort of role-playing these parts in the class. It created a little bit of sort of antagonism between the two groups, right? What would happen is one student would stand up and make some beautiful argument in favor of the Constitution, and all his classmates who were on that side of the issue would start going, yes, here, clapping on the tables and this sort of thing. And it really kind of, they got into the spirit of the event. And then somebody on their phone started streaming sort of colonial type period music. And so it was a lot of fun and very powerful. And after doing that once, it was a lot of work to set it up and tear it down. I kept thinking it would be wonderful to have a classroom building dedicated to that type of endeavor, where we could just bring students in. It's already set up like the Assembly Hall and Independence Hall, and recreate this experience over and over. And as I started talking to people on campus and around town about the concept, One of the things that Stuart Morris, who I didn't know well at the time, I knew he was on our board and we had had some interactions at formal functions, he said, look, if you're going to go out and ask people for money for a room, it's the same amount of effort to ask them for money for a building, right? And I never thought in that capacity, it's the same awkwardness and uncomfortable sort of situation as I got this wacky idea and let me present it to you. But he was not only right in terms of the effort, but in terms of the sort of wow factor, a building actually captures people's attention much greater than a room. And of course, Independence Hall was the natural classroom to go to. So in 2013, I flew to Philadelphia to get the blueprints from the director of Independence Hall there. They're in the National Archives, and she was very helpful. And that became the basis for sort of sketching it out on what it would look like on campus. And automatically we saw that you'd have this great historic, iconic building and these historic rooms. It would need additional classroom space. So that sort of got us talking about the need for additional classroom buildings as well. When I discussed the idea initially with Dr. Sloan, it's a funny story. I'm pretty sure he scheduled the meeting, the conversation. And I thought he was going to say, this is a great idea, but let's just call it off. Or, it's a little kind of crazy. Instead, he sort of wanted me to talk him through it. What's the idea? What would be the utility of the building? And he sort of thought about it for a minute, and then I remember he sort of pulled out a map of campus, and his next question would be, where do we put it? And at that point in time, I was hopeful he was sort of embracing the idea, and of course he came along very quickly because he's a very entrepreneurial leader. And he also shared our concerns about the sort of the direction of students coming in with no understanding of American history and no civic literacy and that sort of thing. So Dr. Morris, as is his case, says he loves American history too. He wanted to help on the project. And I did not know at the time that he and his family had actually been involved with recreating and rebuilding several other historic colonial era buildings across the nation, four or five of them. I know there are two here in Houston. One was, it was a part of their family bank or their family business at the time. It's down on Highway 59 in Sugar Land. It's a building that looks like Jefferson's home, Monticello. I mean, it's an exact replica. And right behind that, there's a replica of one of Jefferson's summer homes called Poplar Forest. So it looks like you're there in Charlottesville, Virginia, among these historic homes, and it's right down Highway 59. So I didn't know that when we were having these initial discussions, that he actually sort of shared my love for this time period and that colonial architecture, and particularly those iconic buildings of the American founding. That was just sort of providential in that sense. He began to get interested in the project. He opened up his paper Rolodex, his contact list, and started calling people to sort of get them on board and excited about the project. And we worked on it from about 2013 to just a year or two ago to sort of build the funding we needed to make the project complete. And I think as Dr. Morris became more and more enthusiastic, more and more concerned about the future of our country, that he and his family wanted to make sort of the lead gift to make this happen. And that's where we are today. I mean, the building is being constructed as we speak. They're in the process of putting up these bricks that look just like the ones in Philadelphia. And it will be the only full-scale replica of Independence Hall in the United States outside of the one in Philadelphia.
Wow.
There's some other sort of variations of it in different parts of the country, but they're usually just the center building without the dependencies or just the center tower. And the interiors of those buildings are just props. You see the facade outside, and there's nothing in the interior. So ours will be the closest you can get to being in Philadelphia without actually being in Philadelphia.
It must just bless your heart to see this unfolding of the vision. I mean, as we look at the building, I mean, tell us what you envision once it's up and rolling with all the classrooms. Tell us about how you're going to use the building.
Yeah, so most people are familiar with what Independence Hall looks like. And so when you're facing it, the flat front is the north side of the building, which is, I'm talking about, that's the street side of the building, which is the front of the building.
Yeah.
And that's the one that you'll see here when you drive in. When you walk into that building, on your left, there will be the famous assembly room where the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were created. And at the time period, that building was actually the Philadelphia State Assembly building where the Philadelphia State Legislature met. Mm-hmm. But they gave up the facility for the purpose of this national convention, and now we call it Independence Hall, the famous room. So that room will be as historically accurate as we can create it. And we like to have special lectures in there, special classes to focus on particular topics. When we bring in school groups to bring the school kids in, to dress them up in little tricorn hats and long coats, have them sit at the tables and maybe do some of these recreations over the Constitutional Convention or Independence, to make sort of the study of American history a little more exciting than just facts and dates and names, right? This sort of living history idea. And we actually piloted some curriculum for that several years ago before the building was even being sort of framed out, where we had kids come to campus. They were middle schoolers. And we had fake bundles of tea, which we went up to the top of our beautiful McNair Hall in the theater and had them throw off the tea and scream "Down with the King" and that sort of stuff. We got stick horses and had them run around the quad loop, you know, screaming "The British are coming." And that age group in particular has a whole lot of energy. And the teachers were appreciative that we could help burn that energy off, you know, so they were tired when they went home. And then at the end, we had a signing of the Declaration of Independence. And I never forget, I had one of my faculty colleagues dressed up as the King of England with a crown and a big red fur ermine coat. And we had him hiding behind the curtains in Dunham Theater, which is, you know, this beautiful facility. And we had some sort of some regal kind of Baroque music playing, and the kids walked in, and I had them line up in front of the stage. And then the curtains part, and there's my colleague with a spotlight on him, sitting there like the King of England at the throne. And you could hear this audible gasp among the students, like, you know, it was really the king type of thing, because they're at that age. So those are types of things we want to do with that age group in that particular room. That's really the heart of the whole building. On the right-hand side was a courtroom, and that room will be modeled after the courtroom as it looked in the 18th century. So we can teach law classes there and criminal justice and have special lectures about the law then and now. There used to be these jury boxes on both sides of that room where the jury would sit. We will probably remove those so more people can sort of squeeze in because they take up a lot of space, but we'll mark them on the floor. So that has a particular function that time and place, but it'll be part of the tour of what the building was used for. On the second floor was a ballroom. So I guess we could have balls and dances there if we wanted. It'll be a banquet hall for our purposes. And the way it's been designed is we can host dinner functions or meal functions there that will seat about 170 people.
Wow.
So a nice-sized banquet hall for campus. And in a lecture format with just chairs lined up, almost 400 people in that facility. So it'll be a nice sort of intermediate size venue, something that the campus can use, because we have some very intimate venues, we have some very large venues. This will sort of be that sweet spot right in between. But we could see this for bringing in guest speakers, for statesmen who come to our campus, for special events, and it'll be a very, very beautiful banquet room on the second floor.
You know, there's a book that's pretty well known called Cultural Literacy that talks about cultural literacy. And then Prothera in Boston College wrote religious literacy and about how illiterate people are religiously. American literacy, I mean, we are at a unique age right now. I mean, we see these politicians that are advocating a way of life that's like quasi-socialism. I mean, and there's a whole generation. I mean, you know this better than anybody. Yeah. They don't know the story of America.
Yeah.
Tell us how serious that reality is and why it needs to be remedied.
Yeah, and it's not just the young people who are in the public school, the school system now, it's also the students coming into college. And this was really the impetus for when we started the academic program back in 2007. We saw a large number of students coming to us with no understanding of American history or knowledge of our country's founding documents or founding principles. And most people aren't aware that even in colleges these days, the traditional American history requirement has been dropped.
Mm-hmm.
You still have to take a history requirement, but it can be like the history. These are classes I've actually looked up, like the history of baseball, right, the history of jazz. Or the history gets balkanized, right? You can take like women's history or Jewish history or a Hispanic history. And all those are important courses to understand our nation's history and our people. But it has come at the expense of that common narrative of where we came from as a people and how our country has progressed. So major events in American history, like the Pilgrims coming in 1620, or the American Revolution, the creating of the Constitution, the American Civil War, the Civil Rights Movement, the students don't understand the timelines, who the major players were, what the issues were. And as a result of that, it's very hard to sort of assess progress that the country has made, failures that the country faces, because there's no common frame of reference.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's very frustrating. People will often attribute to our founding documents things that aren't in them. And I think part of this is because most people are getting their news and their history now from social media, from
sure.
Twitter, TikTok, those places. And you can't do much in 15 seconds, right? You just don't have the ability to impart important information. So it's a very frustrating reality for me and my colleagues. A lot of the students don't read as much anymore just because there's more demand for their attention with all the social media outlets, and I get that. But I'm sure it was different. I'm sure other generations before me would say the same thing, would even make a better case. But even when I started maybe 20 years ago in the late 90s, we would read as part of a freshman government class, John Locke's Second Treatise on Government. It's 90 pages long, which is not particularly long, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 10 years ago, I culled that down to select chapters because I found the students would complain and wouldn't do their reading. Probably 5 years ago, I've culled that down to select passages, right? And I'm getting to the point where I just want to sort of like bullet point what this is about for them. And if you're not willing to make the commitment to read these documents on your own, right, and to have your own eyes sort of witness them, then they never really become part of who you are. It's just people telling you about them. So part of our mission, and particularly in the classes we teach here, is we really want our students to dig deep into those documents. They're beautiful pieces of prose,
mm-hmm.
And they're unique in the world, throughout the world. Right? Not every country has sort of a missional statement like the Declaration of Independence,
mm-hmm.
or a form of government like the U.S. Constitution. I always end my freshman government classes, and this is a spoiler alert for people who are going to sign up, but after we've studied these documents all semester and looked at the way the government operates and the principles of our country and things that we do well, things we don't do well, for all of our problems as a nation, the last slide to me is the most telling, and that is the number one destination for immigrants in the country today, regardless if you're from Asia, South America, Central America, the Middle East, Africa, is still the United States. Right? And that tells me something, that we're not perfect, but we're doing something right. And people still see more opportunity for hope and freedom and liberty and to realize who they can be here than any other place on the face of the planet.
And that's no question at all. I mean, in the United Kingdom, for instance, I mean, everyone aspires to America.
Yeah.
Before we run out of time, I want to talk about the initiative of free enterprise that is a strategic, and I love this about the what you're doing, how important free enterprise is. Can you address that and why it's a distinctive in the Morris Center for Law and Liberty soon to open at HBU?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we tend to sort of think of, we have, if you think of sort of the main Independence Hall complex and the two classroom buildings, I like to sort of envision them or imagine them as dedicated to three different aspects of liberty. And most of the time when we talk about liberty, immediately we go to the concept of political liberty, that we don't want the government to oppress us or have soldiers with bayonets show up at our home and that sort of stuff. But there's two other very important aspects, and they're all equally important, almost like three legs of a stool. Religious liberty, which we hear a lot about, particularly here at the university,
right?
And economic liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that gets forgotten a lot. And
mm-hmm.
so, because we have such a focus on political liberty and religious liberty, we wanted to make sure we had that third leg of the stool and add that economic liberty component. Private property, according to John Locke, in my opinion, is one of those God-given rights, right? In essence, you should be able to reap what you sow. As Lincoln says, no man has a right to your sweat and labor to take what you have provided for yourself. And so private property is fundamental because if the government can take it, in essence, your whole existence is in jeopardy, right? If the government can take your home, if they can take your paycheck, if they can take your oxen, your cart, whatever you want to call it, you basically are at the whim and mercy of the government. And I would argue that for many people who come to the United States, that protection of private property is the fundamental reason, because
mm-hmm.
they live in countries where it doesn't exist.
Sure.
And as an interesting story, I was my car was in the shop the other day. I took an Uber to campus. And the guy's driving me, he's a young Pakistani man. He pulls in, he says, "Oh, you work at HBU?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And he says, "What do you do here?" And I said, "I'm a professor." He says, "Oh, that's really interesting." And we had like a 15-minute conversation in the car, probably while the meter's running, right? And And he says, my father, because I was born here in the United States, my father was born in Pakistan, and I says, what did your father do? And he says, well, he owns a series of convenience stores, and he sort of laughed, because that's not uncommon. And he says, but his father gets up every day and says he thanks God that he lives in a country where he doesn't have to worry about the government or other people stealing his prop, burning it down, right, or rival factions burning it down. And that's not the norm in most parts of the world.
Right.
And I really believe it is what is sort of drive the engine of ingenuity and prosperity. Most people have a desire to do better for themselves and their family. And that fundamental right of private property to benefit from your own labor is essential to that.
I noticed that you've been featured in a lot of publications, including The Federalists. And I'm just finishing a book called China Backlash that The Federalists kind of was instrumental in the writing of. And really been immersing my mind in China. 30 to 40 million people killed in the Cultural Revolution. Yeah. Xi Jinping, lack of property.
Right.
A totalitarian facial recognition, nearly a billion cameras that are recording you.
Yeah.
90 million communists that are controlling over 1.2 billion people. You know, when you travel globally, every time I come back to America, I say, oh, thank God for the United States. Because there's something special about this country.
Well, there is. And, I was sort of cognizant of the fact that there are things that we can do better. But I also realized that if we did not exist as a country, I don't know where refugees would go. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe Canada. But that would be the thing. But it's here that they want to come because of that very reason for an opportunity to make a better life for yourself because of the political liberty, religious liberty, and economic liberty that we talked about. In addition to China, which I realize they have even instituted a thing they called a social credit cachet
Every person's assigned a number and it's monitored regularly.
Right, by how loyal you are to the county's central government.
Absolutely. It is an algorithm on your entire being, person, money, everything.
So if you speak out against the government, your score gets lowered.
Your score goes
down. It harder for you to get a job, take out a loan, buy a house. So the government, in essence, controls your freedom of conscience
totally.
That way. But I also think about the people of Afghanistan, when the troops pulled out of there in the past month or so, all those people who put their lives in jeopardy to not only get on those planes that were evacuating, but clung to the wings and wheels of those planes, and many of them plummeted to their death.
Yes.
To try to catch a plane to the United States. That tells you something about the way people see the opportunity and the freedom here that doesn't exist elsewhere.
So well said. I mean, Chris Hammons, we just thank God for you, what you're doing, your leadership at Houston Baptist University. Dr. Chris Hammons, the director of the Morris Family Center for Law and Liberty. I want to show you a little more footage of that building going up that'll soon be celebrating, in summer 2022?
We do. We hope to have the main building open by July 4th. That's sort of our,
Are we going to blow off fireworks?
Well, maybe.
In the
that would be
deal?
Pretty cool. And have fireworks on the 4th of July. And then hopefully have the first classroom building open for classes in the fall. That's the goal. And then the second classroom building will begin sometime this spring. So it may be a little bit later in terms of being open.
Fantastic. Way to
Thank
let
so
God
much.
Use you. I mean, if you want to learn more about Dr. Hammons, see Hammons, H-A-M-M-O-N-S, at hbu.edu. Of course, hbu.edu/arts/humanities and hbu.edu/law/liberty. There is a place for you at HBU, and we want to remind you of that. There's no question that you ask that we can't provide, hopefully, a caring answer so that you can find your home at HBU. hbu.edu/admissions, 281-649-3211. Our graduate school, hbu.edu/grad, 281-649-3269. And we do want to pause and thank God for sacrificial givers like the founding father, Stuart Morris, celebrating his 102nd birthday, unbelievable, and others. Remember HBU in your giving, particularly now as we come to year end. Many of us who are Christ-focused know that every dollar we have is God's. He gives it to us as a steward, and then we voluntarily get to give back. And I hope you do what my wife and I do. We reconcile the money we have, and we make sure that we've given God back all of His. That's an opportunity to give. you can give here at HBU, hbu.edu/giving, 281-649-3222. And remember, the vision here at HBU is supported by your charity giving, and of course, a tax deductible receipt, and a great letter of appreciation will be sent to you. Thank you so much for remembering HBU and your giving plans as we close this year. Dr. Hammons, thanks so much for what you're doing, man. It's exciting. Can't wait to see it happen, and I know it will. So keep on leading.
Here at HBU, we influence the culture around us by challenging our students to put their beliefs into action every day.